HBX Core, teaching the language of business. Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining me for this week's Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. At the AGET conference in June, I spoke to a couple of people on the HBS admission staff and asked them how applicants with less than stellar undergraduate records can show that they are new and improved. In other words, that they are now focused, mature, and ready and able to perform, which they weren't in college. They responded that HBX Core, while it doesn't guarantee admission, does show them that you can perform in an HBS kind of environment if you complete it with high marks. They clearly saw it as a credible credential. Naturally, I wanted to learn more, and I'm delighted to have Admission Straight Talk listeners learn more along with me, since I'm talking today to Patrick Mullane, director of HBX Core. Patrick served as a captain in the U.S. Air Force in the early 90s and then moved into the world of business. He earned his MBA from Harvard Business School and then again returned to the business world, ran his own company, and now is back at HBS as director of HBX Core. Patrick, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thanks, Linda. It's great to be here.
And I'm delighted to have you join me. Now, can you please give just an overview of HBX Core and its curriculum? What will participants learn?
Sure. Well, HBX Core is a three-course program that includes a course on economics, one on accounting, and one on business analytics. And those three topics were chosen by the faculty as kind of the three fundamental areas, at least in our first entree into the market, three fundamental areas that anybody who's going to be in business will have to have some knowledge in. And it was originally created to be directed at people who were late in their undergraduate careers and were studying perhaps liberal arts disciplines as an example, or for people who were interested in going to business school and thought this might be a good way to get themselves up to speed, to maybe refresh their memory if they already had experience in these disciplines. Although I will say, and we can talk about this later maybe, that as the offerings put out there, we do find people of all stripes are taking it, but certainly we have a good concentration of people in those two areas that I just spoke about.
Mm-hmm. So they're studying economics, accounting, and what was the third one again?
Business analytics.
Business analytics.
A lot of it's statistics, but with a business bent.
Okay. And how are they learning it? It's all remote, right?
Sure, yes. This aspect of HBX is what we call asynchronous, meaning it's not that somebody is on the other side of it at the exact time you are communicating knowledge to you. It's a more traditional, if you want to think anything's traditional in this space, online offering. The one thing that really sets it apart, though, well, I would say the prime thing that sets it apart, is that Harvard Business School built this from scratch rather than using already existing online platforms. Because the school, as most people probably listening to this podcast might know, is really centered around the case method of learning. And so when we set out to create something here at the Harvard Business School, there was a strong preference to make sure that the content was case content and delivered with that learning style, that pedagogy that Harvard Business School pioneered about 100 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than it just being a professor or faculty member lecturing and then going to maybe some text with some knowledge checks, ours is really about case protagonists, so a real business with a real person who's trying to do something real and going on a process of learning discovery with that protagonist as you make your way through the course.
And so let's say somebody's taking accounting, just for example. So there's the protagonist, and he faces a problem. Are they also having an econ textbook that they're reviewing in order to help the protagonist with his or her accounting problem?
No, all of the content is online. We do have some study sheets that the students can print out, PDFs, but there is no accompanying text with it. It's completely self-contained on the platform. So in the example of accounting, we have a case on a small business, actually. That's the other thing great about it. You know, a lot of students aren't going to be in Fortune 500 companies, and while we have some cases around, for example, Amazon, we also have a case on a company called Cardulo's, which is a specialty kind of delicatessen and food shop in Harvard Square. Mm-hmm. And the woman who runs that business is in the program talking about how she does accounting in her business, in, you know, the import of goods that she sells, and the things she has to worry about from an accounting perspective. So the student is learning along with somebody who's really facing these things, you know, day to day.
I understand the practical application, but like when I think back on my accounting classes long, long ago, I had to learn what a debit was, what a credit was, what an income statement was a balance sheet, cash flow. Sure. So how are they going to get that information?
Great question. So all of those concepts are delivered in the context of the case, though. So when when you talk to somebody who's running a Cardulo's and she mentions as a kind of an introductory aspect to it what the business mm-hmm. does, then it might cut to a faculty member saying, you know, as the woman who runs the business mentioned, she imports goods that she then puts on her shelves. This is known as inventory. And then mm-hmm. how do you account for the inventory once it's sold? Does the inventory have a life that might, you know, go bad if it's a perishable? How do you think about that? So those are the sorts of ways that the concepts are introduced, but they're given a real world structure around them that I think for most people makes it easier to kind of absorb and make it usable going forward.
And where, I mean, is everybody typically at home when they're doing this?
We find a lot of students. We have a closed Facebook group mm-hmm. that's connected to the experience as well. And so often you'll see people chiming into their classmates that they're on a business trip, as an example, and doing it from a hotel somewhere. Right. Sometimes people are doing it on airplanes. Sometimes they're doing it on a beach. But, you know, typically, I'm sure most are doing it at home.
Right. At the gym. How long does HBX Core last, and how many hours does it typically require?
The number of hours is around 170 hours of actual on-platform time. So it's a pretty intensive course. We survey students who say they spend about the same amount of time off the platform just studying and reviewing notes they may have taken. The amount of time the course lasts actually varies, so the content never changes, and really, frankly, the amount of time you probably have to invest in it doesn't change. But we have a course that might last 8 weeks, which means it's going to be a lot more intensive because you have to dedicate a lot more time to get it finished. But we also have some as long as 18 weeks. We've actually done an 18-week recently. But there is a definitive start and end time to a given wave or core cohort. And that's because since it is the case method, the other key part of the case method that makes it work is being on a path of learning discovery with your peers who are taking the material with you. So we gate the material, meaning we have a specific start time and we have quizzes at particular times to roughly keep students working through the program at roughly the same pace so that they can help each other through the content. There's a peer help feature in the platform that allows them to ask questions of the peers or challenge their peers or debate something with their peers on given pieces of content. And if you had people racing ahead, say, of the group who might be very knowledgeable and might be able to help their peers, that's not what we want. In fact, if you think about the Harvard Business School MBA program, it's similar thinking to how we do things in the bricks and mortar world, if you will. Just because you may have an accounting degree doesn't mean you get out of the accounting course in a first year of your MBA program here, because you're expected to read the same cases that your less experienced peers read and then use your knowledge to help them understand what's going on in the case.
Right. And obviously the program is aimed for people with minimal or no background in business, but do you have people sometimes signing up with more background?
Yes, we do. I'm not sure on the percentages, but one interesting piece of data that I've seen is we actually use people who have backgrounds and disciplines kind of as our benchmarking. And what I mean by that is I have a chart I'll show sometimes that shows the final exam scores for people who already had experience in a given discipline mm-hmm. and the final exam scores of people who didn't. And those that already had experience in the discipline only outperform those that didn't by a few percentage points.
Oh, really?
So, that's a pretty nice proxy for showing the efficacy of the content. You know, people seem to learn it when they didn't know it before.
For sure. Now, one of the other hallmarks of, or I think it's more of an outgrowth of the case method, or part of the way that the MBA program is approached at HBS, of course, as a study group. Is there something analogous in HBX Core?
Yes, in kind of two different forms, I'd say. It's interesting you bring that up, because I wrote a LinkedIn article recently about the study group and how important I think it was to my HBS experience.
I saw Sparky, but I missed that one.
Oh, yeah. Sparky the Wonder Dog, yes.
Right.
It's the latest article I wrote is on that very topic.
Okay.
Of the study groups. And so in the platform, the way it happens is through that peer help I mentioned to you before and it's very different than a bulletin board. And we get feedback from those who have taken CORE that they find it very effective. And the reason it's different is because when you click on the peer help icon on the sidebar of the page you're on, you're only going to see questions and answers related to the content that's on the page you're looking at. So it's very contextual. It also doesn't allow you to look at peer help content that you haven't gotten to yet. You know, the case method is a method of discovery, so you're only revealed information as you complete specific parts of the course. And so you can't, you know, see peer help for items that you haven't gotten to yet. That might ruin the learning experience for you. So that's one way in which you kind of replicate the study group, which is the opportunity. I guess for those who don't know, I should say study groups at HBS are, as you mentioned, Linda, are integral to the experience, where in the first year, you're going to get together with people usually in the morning before you go to class, and you will share your insights on the cases you've done and even share some of the work. The other way in HBX that it happens is that students actually coordinate getting together in the cities they're in, and just literally having a face-to-face study group at a coffee shop or something like that. So it actually happens as it does at the business school as well. It's probably more limited, obviously, given that you're not living on campus and
sure.
And you're not able to do it probably as frequently. But in talking to students, that's a very common practice among those who take the course.
Especially if they live in bigger cities, I would
Correct.
Imagine.
Yep.
Right. One actually has to apply to HBX Core, but there's no GMAT, there's no GRE, there's no interview, and there's a fairly straightforward application. What are you looking for in the application? Whom do you want to admit? Whom do you think would be better off going elsewhere?
A great question. A little context setting. You know, one thing that's interesting is that a big part of the reason for HBX has to do with the Harvard Business School mission, which is very straightforward. It's to educate leaders that make a difference in the world. And there's really this thought here that the advent of technology has really helped us find ways to extend that mission, because as the dean himself would say, and as I've said when I talk on this topic, is that I think everybody can agree that there's more than 900 people, which is roughly an incoming MBA class here each year.
Right.
There's more than 900 people in the world who could excel in the content and benefit from the content. I think we can all agree that's almost a certainty. So the question then is, how do you reach them? Now, when it comes to HBX, and CORE in particular, we really want to be, as we often say, selective, not exclusive. So we're not looking to make this be, you know, another 10% admissions rate kind of program. We want to reach as many people as we can who we think will benefit from, in the case of CORE, some basic business skills. When we ask people to apply, there are two reasons to do that. We want to test for their engagement and how, you know, excited they are to do something like this. There's some barrier to get there because it's a rigorous program and requires people to be really committed to it. I said two things, really three things. We also do some light testing of analytic ability just to make sure that they're going to be able to have a baseline of analytic skills. And the other one is a couple of essays where we want to see their reasons for wanting to do the program, and also to test for language proficiency, because CORE is only offered in English, so obviously you need to be able to speak English well.
Mm-hmm.
So those are really the criteria. What's interesting about how we've done admissions is our first kind of cohort of students was when we did a soft launch of the product, and we invited students from all of the, you know, what people would call, I guess, the elite liberal arts colleges in the Northeast, and then some children of alumni. And the assumption was at the time that those students and their grades they got in the course would never be surpassed by an open enrollment program with our admissions practices. And we've actually been very wrong about that. Every wave of students we've had after that have performed just as well. and if not better in many cases, than that first wave of students. So it did kind of validate our thought that there's plenty of people out there who can master and excel at this content, and we'd like to reach even more of them.
And you mentioned that they have to demonstrate some analytics ability and I guess some verbal skills. Now, are you looking for verbal skills beyond the essay? And if so, how? And in terms of the analytics, how, I mean, they have to do like a problem set in the application. How does that work?
Yeah, it's basically like chart reading type stuff. You can be able to look at data and interpret and analyze it from that perspective. And then, yes, there's nothing beyond the written essay. With respect to the verbal skills.
Okay. Now, HBS is, of course, famous for the interactive nature of its learning. And you've talked about engagement in terms of HBX core. And I guess one way you get it is through the peer groups. But how else do you encourage that engagement in this asynchronous form of learning? My daughter once took an online master's course, and she was very happy with the content of the course, but you know, my image of her is sitting by herself watching videos.
Yeah, it's great. Great question. And it is beyond the actual two things I mentioned already, which is the online peer help and the closed Facebook groups where a lot of interaction happens. Really, it gets back to designing the core, the platform originally from the ground up and being very student-centered versus delivery or faculty-centered. And I know that sounds like buzzwords, but let me explain, is that in every moment in making the platform, there was always the question of, will the participant be leaning forward in their seat, anticipating some more good stuff to come? And that led to a principle of not having anything last for more than about 3 minutes for a given learner, and also to make sure that it's not enough to say, okay, 3 minutes of video, 3 minutes of text. You need to have 3 minutes of lots of different things. So in a typical 100 minutes of a core curriculum, you're going to see a whole lot of different activities, varied activities for a much shorter time than you do in other online courses. And we know this because we studied it. We actually have a chart that shows, you know, activities by color over 100 minutes. So you imagine two bars. The bar for HBX core has a whole lot of different colors and a whole lot of different slices, and a lot of small slices.
Yeah.
The bar for a representative, these are two economics comparisons, an economics course in one of the large well-known MOOCs is much less colorful, and the bars tend to be a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So we really made an effort to kind of reach for that, a bar that would look that way, if you will. And the other thing that I think we have that is just well beyond anything I've ever seen out there, and I've already said that, I think, about the video quality, but we spend a lot of time and effort on interactives and animations that help engage the students and explain things in ways that you could never do in a classroom. And in fact, one of the interesting side benefits of creating CORE and other HBX courses is that faculty members have said it's really helped them think through how to explain something in a very different way. And if you can imagine, as a matter of fact, imagine you're a faculty member, an economics faculty member, sitting down with an animator to try and explain a concept that you then want them to turn into an animation that's going to show up on the course. Yeah, I think you can see where I'm going here. No offense to all our animators out there, but most of your animators
I thought it might be offense to economists, actually, more than the animators.
It can go both ways. So an economist having an animator, the economist has probably never had a challenge like this, and the animator has probably never cracked open an economics book. So
right.
Kind of these two worlds colliding that force each of them to cooperatively figure out how to demonstrate something in a way that's going to make sense to an average user. And the faculty members that I've spoken to have gone through this process say it's just a wonderful exercise for them. And so we have a lot of animations on our platform that explain concepts in ways that I think are very, very engaging and keep people, as I say, kind of leaning forward in their seats. And then the interactives themselves, meaning it's not just an animation they're watching, but they have to actually do something. It could be something like, moving a slider along a demand curve to see when you get a price elasticity of one, and knowing that that represents the optimal price point at a given volume to maximize mm-hmm. your revenue. You know, that stuff I learned when I was a student here, but the animation we have, the interactive we have, that the student can, you know, click on and drag the slider to see what happens when you move up and down the demand curve is something that you can't even do on a chalkboard, right? It's very difficult right. to show that. So it's a really, really cool way to keep people engaged. And then the last thing I'll mention in the interactives area is we've replicated the cold call in the platform. So at any given time, about in points in the course, about a third of the class will be asked to answer a cold call. For those, I think most of your audience will be familiar, but a cold call is usually when a professor opens a class, they will turn to a student they've selected in advance. The student doesn't know they're going to be called on. And the student then has to answer whatever question the professor asks. So as you can imagine, in a classroom with 80 to 90 people in it, your peers, that can be pretty stressful, particularly if you haven't done your homework. So the way we replicated that on the platform is, as you're going through the course, all of a sudden, remember, stuff's being revealed to you as you complete given tasks, so you can't really look ahead. So when you click continue at some point, you're going to be presented with a message that says you've been selected for a cold call. When you click this button, and there's a button there, you'll have 2 minutes to answer the question that's going to appear. And when you click that button, the question about the content will appear, and there'll be a countdown clock. And in some ways, I would argue it's more stressful than a real cold call, because you don't have a countdown clock in a real cold call. you know, you're watching that ticker tick down as you're trying to type a pithy and insightful comment into the text box. And then when you click done, that cold call content you just wrote gets shared with all your peers in your class, who can then make comments about it or rate it and give their thoughts about how you did. So it's needless to say, if you're chugging along and that pops up, it's a little stressful. You don't want to look like you didn't do your homework, so to speak.
So if you get that cold call, I don't know what the question would be. What would be the optimal price point under these circumstances based on what we learned, for example? And let's say Sally is picked for the cold call. Do all her peers see the question at the same time, and they realize that Sally is being picked for that cold call? Because, of course, what happens in the real classroom.
They'll know after the fact, because as soon as she clicks that submit button, her uh-huh. comments get put at the location in the course there, so others that come by as they're going on their journey will be able to see how she responded to that question.
And then they can comment. So then there is interactivity between the participants, not just between the program and the individual.
Right. Correct.
Got it. That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Now, CORE stands for Certificate of Readiness. What is credential of readiness.
Right.
What is the credential, and what does it prepare holders to do?
Yeah, it's interesting. Me correcting you there, I didn't mean to sound abrupt, but it's...
No, that's fine.
We actually make distinctions. We think of the credential as kind of honoring the fact that you went through something that had some rigor to it. You know, CORE has a number of quizzes throughout it for every module in the course. And then you have to take a final exam in person at a Pearson Learning Center somewhere around the world.
Are your responses to cold calls also part of your grade?
Yes, all of your participation is part of the grade, because cold call is not the only way you participate. We ask people to do shared reflections as well, and those are part of the grade as well.
What are shared reflections? I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh, no, that's all right. Shared reflection, think of a cold call without the cold call. It'll just be it'll be like a warm call, where you've studied a concept and ask you, you know, given what you've just learned, you know, how would you think about depreciating a building versus an automobile in a business? And I'm making stuff up here, obviously. And then the student isn't on the clock. They can take their time to fill in their response. And then if it's a shared reflection, it will be shared with your peers. There are some that are unshared, which are more just a way to prompt the student to think about what they just learned. But shared ones are like a cold call, and that other people can see them. So the credential is, in our mind, the only credential program we currently have is CORE, is a relatively rigorous program that includes heavy assessment, that demonstrates mastery of certain concepts. A certificate for us would be something like our course called Disruptive Strategy with Clay Christensen. That's 30 hours long. There's no final exam. There are reflections and light assessment, I'd call it, but there's no grade. In core, you are graded. You can finish with a pass with honors, pass with high honors, or a fail. So it's just like any other kind of academic experience a lot of the students would be used to. And then we have something else, other sorts of programs where they're more of a certificate of completion if you complete them. We don't have one of those out yet, but we have one coming out in October of this year. So that's kind of the hierarchy. As far as what it prepares you for, this is the interesting one. Is and I was at a conference at Wharton last week where this is a big topic of discussion, is what is the currency of a credential or certificate going to be in the future? Interestingly, that's a tough question to answer, and partly it's tough because it's like printing money. We've printed, we being the greater online learning community,
right,
has printed a lot of certificates, right? So
right,
it gets very, and credentials, so it gets hard to determine the value. We believe that ours, given the quality of the experience, giving the heavy assessment by most certificate or credential programs standards, ours is the highest level of assessment, particularly since you have to go somewhere and take an in-person final exam.
Yes, you also have to pay for it. You also have to pay for it.
That's another really big factor. I mean, our completion rates are high. We think it's partly because of how great and engaging the course is, but it also makes a difference if you're ponying up the money to take the course. Absolutely.
You're invested.
You're completely invested in it. We would like over time, it's a difficult experiment to run though, but to determine the value in a more scientific way than just anecdotal from the students. Mm-hmm. That said, the anecdotal feedback we get back from students is quite supportive in this regard. I mean, we hear from people all the time. We had a student who told us that it was the topic of a conversation, an interview he had with his dream job, and it made a huge difference in him getting the job he believes. We've had people tell us they were in a technical discipline and taking the course, and that helps them to think in a more business way, which is, you know, impress their managers and may have led to them getting a raise or a promotion, things like that. But like CORE, just like many other online programs, much more anecdotal than scientific right now.
And do you ever have, let's say, you know, young entrepreneurs, not necessarily young, entrepreneurs? You mentioned the store in Harvard Square, but do you ever have, you know, entrepreneurs saying, I need some business background, I don't want to go to school full time and enrolling in HBS CORE?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, just an anecdote around that was kind of interesting. We invited anybody who had taken any of our courses to come to campus back in May on their own dime, and weren't sure if anybody was going to show up. We had almost 500 show up. It was hugely successful and attended. They came back for a day of experiencing going to a classroom. They actually got to sit in some case studies with 9 faculty members we had come to it. Did a whole lot of other things. It was really just an awesome experience. And I was talking to a gentleman at that who told me, I think he was from either Mississippi or Louisiana, mm-hmm. and he was a pastor of a church, or mm-hmm. at a church. He actually was an associate pastor at a church who was now going to go off and try and start his own church in rural Louisiana or Mississippi, and realized that running a church is like running a business. And he didn't have any formal training in it. So this was a really convenient way for him to get a high quality course in business fundamentals before he went off and started this church. So that's certainly an entrepreneurial enterprise, not one most people think of.
No, definitely it is.
But we do have a number of people, let me say it this way. People self-report to us their title in their organization. And a disproportionately large number of them have chief executive or founder or something like that.
Right.
And given the age of those attending, the conclusion you can draw from that is a lot of them are starting their own businesses or have started their own business.
Okay, thank you. Now, you mentioned that, you know, when you were designing the program, it was aimed at recent college grads, basically.
Yep.
And or maybe even current college students approaching graduation. Can they get credits for HBX Core?
You can get credit, but we're not the ones who provide the credit. So we offer Core through two collaborating schools right now, and they're the only way you can get transfer credit. One is through the Harvard Extension School, and the other is Boise State University out in Idaho. We offer it through them as well. So if people want it for credit, those are the only two ways to get it for credit right now.
All right. And what do you have any idea? I suspect you do. Does anybody go through the course without the intention? Getting the credential is part of the experience, right? I mean, people don't just go and say, I'm not interested in the credential, I just want to participate.
Some do, yes. We know if people do not sign up for the final exam, which is the best proxy we have for that. Mm-hmm. People who have completed all the online materials but then never sign up for the final exam, the best guess there is it's people, as you're asking about, they're people who just valued the education and weren't too concerned about having the credential or the grade.
What percentage is that?
I actually don't know.
Oh, all right. Okay, no problem.
It's not a large percentage. It's very small.
Yeah, I would assume so. You might as well get the credential. Exactly. Now there's a long list of testimonials on the HBX site, but in your mind, what is the most, you already mentioned the pastor, that was a pretty good story, but what is the most memorable feedback you've received from those who have completed HBX Core?
I think there's two other stories. One is we've heard from a few people who have learning disabilities.
Yeah.
Or physical disabilities. Uh-huh. And they found a high-quality asynchronous program has been, you know, godsend for them. It's people who never thought they'd be able to be affiliated with Harvard brand and got that opportunity, and not only just got to be affiliated with it, but felt they learned a ton because they're able to, you know, slow down a video or go backwards. You can't go forward, you know, skip ahead, but you can't go back. Mm-hmm. So to be able to revisit concepts, they found has been a liberating way. It's a great way for people who are interested in business school just to test whether or not they'll like the material and whether or not they have the academic fortitude to kind of get through it. So it's really great for that. I'm trying to think if there's any others that have been really, really impactful to me. The only other one I can think of that I kind of make fun of a little bit just to tease my accounting friends is we had a woman, I think she quite literally was something like the stereotypical art history major. Uh-huh. Who made a comment in some sort of focus group we had that she took the course because she knew nothing about business. She thought she probably hated it and really almost took it reluctantly. And she said after she took it, she's pretty convinced she missed her calling and she should have been an accountant. She actually absolutely loves it. Which I teased her.
That's memorable. I can see that. That's really different.
I teased the professor and saying, it sounds like to me we need to recommend a therapist. But,
you're right.
That's really cool to me to kind of open the eyes of somebody through something that I'm involved in and the team here is involved in to show them something that might be a passion is really, really cool to know.
Right. I'd like to turn for a moment from HBX Core to your experience as an HBS, Harvard Business School, not HBX, HBS alum. And that was a few moons ago. What are the takeaways? A little bit. What are the takeaways from that experience that have stood the test of time for you?
There's several. I think, first of all, a big one for me was the power of the case method. Like most people, I never experienced case method learning until I got to HBS, and I found it a very, very powerful way to help a burgeoning business executive, hopefully, to learn how to think about problems in a very holistic way. It taught me a lot, and this is, I mentioned a LinkedIn article I wrote recently about study groups. Study groups are very interesting to me because we quite literally would divide the work. The workload can be quite high, especially on a day when you have to read three cases. So if you imagine three cases, 8 to 15 pages with all the analysis you might have to do, it's really not enough for even the smartest people to do, although there were a few I was in school with, I think, to do by themselves. So you divide up the work often the day before and then meet in the morning, and some people have one piece of the analysis, you might have another piece, and then you brief each other before you walk in the classroom. And I remember saying to a faculty member that this was very odd relative to previous academic experiences, where doing something like that almost felt like cheating, right? It's like having somebody else do your homework for you. And he said to me something I'll never forget, is like, he said that that's a big part of the learning experience at HBS, because if you're going to be a general manager in a business, and that's what Harvard likes to do, is train people who are going to do that, you're never going to know everything yourself. You're going to have people working with and for you who are going to have to provide data to you. You're going to have to find a way to assimilate it quickly in your own mind and then walk into a boardroom or walk in front of a customer and be able to give an articulated answer to questions or give a talk. And nothing could be further from the truth. I was a CEO of a manufacturing company, and I use that skill every single day. Well, I guess mm-hmm. I use it here too. I shouldn't. but that part of the experience hit home to me big time. And then the last one I'll mention, and you probably hear this a lot, is the network you build when you're here.
Yeah.
It's one reason that the dean has said that he doesn't see offering an online MBA degree, because we believe there's something particularly unique about being in a classroom with people on a campus in a kind of residential environment that matters quite a bit. Now, I think technology is making it easier and easier to get closer to that experience. I think it's going to be hard to completely replicate it. And in fact, there's a proxy for this. You know, when video conferencing and teleconferencing came around, everybody said it would kill airlines, and it hasn't. Mm-hmm. If anything, it's increased the amount of air travel. So I think it's similar here. I think there are going to always be two very very different experiences. But that network you build while here is critical. I make the comment that every job I've had since I went to HBS, I got from a connection at HBS. So it does matter, I think, that much. That's the thing we really want to do with our online programs, though, when we think about the future, is how do we build more of a community around the platform itself, so that people who kind of, quote unquote, meet in the online world can stay connected and can use the network, which now in HBX, and in 2 years we've had or currently have 11,500 people going through our programs. That's a pretty big network.
That is a big network.
When you think that's 11 to 12 years worth of MBA graduates. So there's a lot more scale involved.
I was actually wondering if you were not planning to incorporate some kind of offline element officially, as opposed to now it's kind of organically developed in the larger cities, or on a voluntary basis. Maybe just keep it voluntary. I can imagine that would be very popular if for those people who can come to it.
Yeah, I think we have discussed that. You obviously have to be careful about how you scale something like that. And,
sure.
And what we found is, generally speaking, the crowdsourcing model for a lot of things works really well, and the crowd kind of organically does that very well. So if we did anything, I think it's more likely we provide a supporting role and maybe materials, on how to run a great study group or how to run a local event for HBX.
Core alumni?
Right, yeah, so doing something like that.
And I'm also just curious, what percentage of the students are domestic or are in the United States, and how many are international?
Yeah, about 40% of people who take the course, we believe. It gets a little complicated because you've got mailing address, you've got self-reported nationality, and you've got passport. But near as we can tell, it's about 40% or overseas.
Yeah, I would assume it'd be a pretty significant number. Is there any question that you would have liked me to ask that I didn't ask?
Yeah, one we get, and particularly I think your audience would be interested in, is how does having the credential impact your chances of getting into not just Harvard Business School, but any MBA program? And what I always tell people who are asking about with respect to Harvard Business School is that it's like any other academic pursuit you might take before you apply to a business program. If it shows that you're motivated and that you're interested in the topic and that you took the time to study, and if you did well, obviously, we, as I mentioned earlier, we grade and can have people finish with honors or high honors, that probably helps as well. I think net-net, it's a help. We have a kind of a Chinese wall between us and admissions, but we know that it's something that they value as an activity that shows your motivation. And I liken it a lot to when I applied to the MBA program before there were a lot of online courses around, I had a math degree undergrad. I had been in the military, and I was living in Nebraska at the time, and I enrolled in an accounting course at the University of Nebraska because I thought it would show that, again, I was motivated. And I got an A in it, which showed I, particularly since my undergrad grades weren't all great, I think it showed that I could handle business academics. And lo and behold, I was admitted. So I think it's great for anybody who's looking to apply to an MBA program.
When I was at the AGAC conference in June, and the subject of HBX Core came up, and we were talking to admissions people in the admissions office, it was clearly viewed as a very credible credential, not a guarantee of acceptance, you know, nothing like that. But it was something that they took seriously, as especially if one did well, as showing you had the, you know, the ability and the interest to succeed. And by the way, I also took an accounting class before I did my MBA, but I just did it at a local community college. Coming from a political science background, I felt I had to do it because I just didn't have anything on my transcript that showed any interest in business. But I also got in, so it's okay.
Very similar to me. Although I did have a business minor, which helped me out. Math degree is a business minor, but very similar story. I wish they'd had it online. It would have been a heck of a lot more convenient.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Patrick, for joining me today. Where can listeners and potential HBX students learn more about the HBX Core programs?
Yeah, just have everybody check out our website at hbx.hbs.edu. So it's hbx.hbs, like Harvard Business School, .edu.
Okay, great. We'll include links in the show notes at exceba.com/175 to the HBX Core site and also to the article that Patrick referred to on LinkedIn about the best little secret of the Harvard MBA, and perhaps a couple of other items of interest to MBA applicants and people interested in HBX Core. Listener, thank you too for joining Patrick Mullane and me for our 175th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please tell your friends about the useful, informative podcast that you're listening to. I think you will be helping them out, and your friends will appreciate it, and I certainly will appreciate it. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.